From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, how the goals and tactics of terrorists have changed over the past few decades. We talk with Bruce Hoffman, author of Inside Terrorism. He's the director of the Center for the Study of Terrorism and Political Violence, and he advises governments and businesses. Also, Irish writer Sebastian Barry, author of the play The Steward of Christendom, discusses his new historical novel about a man who joins the British-led police force and is blacklisted by his friends in the IRA. And TV critic David Bianculli previews Columbo, Ashes to Ashes, starring Peter Falk. It airs tonight on ABC. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The House of Representatives continues debating a motion to open an inquiry into whether to impeach President Clinton. If the resolution passes today, it would be just the third time in history that Congress has looked into removing a president from office. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
Democrats lost their effort in the Judiciary Committee to limit the time of the inquiry and keep it focused on the Lewinsky matter. They're trying again on the House floor, but that effort is doomed. Now the focus is on how many Democrats will defect and support the Republican proposal for an open-ended inquiry. Democrat Paul McHale of Pennsylvania has urged the president to resign before, and today he indicated he is one Democrat who will vote for the Republican measure.
Having deliberately provided false testimony under oath, the president, in my judgment, forfeited his right to office. It was with a deep sense of sadness that I called for his resignation. By his own misconduct, the president displayed his character and he defined it badly.
Other Democrats rose to condemn the inquiry, insisting the president's behavior is not serious enough to merit impeachment. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
Secretary of State Madeleine Albright says she is convinced NATO will soon agree to take the next step toward ending the violence in the Yugoslav province of Kosovo. She told envoy Richard Holbrooke to return to Yugoslavia today in a last-ditch effort to persuade Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic to stop repressing ethnic Albanians in the region.
We must assume that Milosevic will continue to do the minimum necessary to avoid NATO action. But he has to understand that the minimum is not good enough. The only thing that is good enough is full compliance.
NATO has threatened the use of military airstrikes to force Milosevic to stop his crackdown in Kosovo. NASA engineers continue preparing the Discovery Shuttle for a mission at the end of the month. Senator John Glenn of Ohio and six other astronauts are training for a space mission set to begin in about 3 weeks. Pat Duggins of member station WMFE reports.
John Glenn and his crewmates will spend today at the launch pad where Space Shuttle Discovery is parked. This is also the crew's last chance to check out their cargo, which includes a shiny gold box-like satellite called Spartan. Glenn's mission will be commanded by veteran astronaut Kurt Brown.
The practice countdown always marks a big milestone in our training. We get to come down and see all the folks here at Kennedy Space Center. Get into the real vehicle, see the real equipment again.
The crew will also make final checks of the fit of their 90-pound bright orange pressure suits. NASA made the bulky suits mandatory following the Challenger accident. This is John Glenn's return to space after becoming the first American in orbit in 1962. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins in Orlando.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 228 points at 7,513. Trading is heavy. The NASDAQ is off 76. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, there seems to be no shelter from the current economic storm for stock market investors. Markets from Tokyo to New York have been tumbling today. NPR's Jack Spear is live to explain.
Well, the global sell-off that began on the Tokyo Stock Exchange with the Nikkei losing 6% of its value subsequently swept through Europe today and has now hit Wall Street. On U.S. stock markets, the mood has been decidedly pessimistic today as investors try to figure out what sectors, if any, in the market might offer safe haven. Even normally safe cash looked less attractive today as the dollar plunged to a 15-month low against the Japanese yen after falling more than 16% earlier in the week. Meanwhile, there are signs the still robust U.S. economy may also be showing some signs of weakness. A report from Giant Citicorp that expects third-quarter losses of $700 million, the result mostly of overseas trading, did not help markets today. On the economic front, the government announced stocks of unsold goods on retailers' shelves rose 0.9%. At the same time, wholesale sales fell 1.2%. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
President Clinton has vetoed an agriculture spending bill containing a $4.2 billion GOP-backed emergency farm aid plan. The White House says the farm aid plan was inadequate. The president wants House and Senate negotiators to go back to work to try to fashion a new package, even though Congress plans to adjourn this weekend. American Airlines has reportedly had to cancel flights as it faces a pilot shortage. The Wall Street Journal says the combination of the decline in the stock market and a benefit quirk has prompted the flight. American pilots take retirement money in a lump sum from a mutual fund. Their contract provides for a 3-month window so they can leave. They can take money out of their mutual fund at July prices. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, offering a world to explore through books and music. Location information, 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Terrorists have been adapting new tactics, and the American government is trying to figure out how to react. The Clinton administration is restructuring its plan for responding to terrorist attacks involving chemical or biological weapons. My guest Bruce Hoffman has written a new book about past and present trends in terrorism and what those trends say about why terrorists do what they do. His new book is called Inside Terrorism. He directs the Center for the Study of Terrorism and Political Violence at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, and he's about to take on his new position as director of the RAND Corporation's Washington office, where he will focus on terrorism research. Hoffman says that the Irgun, the Jewish group that revolted against British rule in Palestine, established a revolutionary model which was emulated by terrorist groups around the world. The Irgun was commanded by Menachem Begin, who later became the Prime Minister of Israel. I asked Hoffman about the new and effective tactics the group used.
Begin was very savvy in an era long before CNN and long before global media as we know it now in its most immediate daily form. He realized that the most effective way to get the British out of Palestine wasn't necessarily to beat them on the battlefield, but to beat them, let's say, in the war of propaganda, and to appeal not to an audience, as previous acts of violence, revolutionary violence, had been done, to an audience within your own country to rise up. So his strategy was to appeal to world opinion, and particularly to take the struggle, at least psychologically, outside of Palestine, back to London, back to the British voter, but I think pivotally, also to New York and to the nascent United Nations organization, and to bring international pressure to bear on Britain by, in Begin's words, turning Palestine into a glass house that no one could, you know, ignore looking at, but at the same time, everybody was looking into, and thus putting pressure on the British to leave.
And you think that became a model for other terrorist groups?
Yes, I think certainly the most successful terrorist groups of the 1950s, let's say, the first generation of post-war anti-colonialist groups, those organizations that similarly sought to appeal to international opinion were more effective. And by this, I'm thinking of the FLN in Algeria, who in their revolt against French rule choreographed or orchestrated their biggest acts of violence to coincide with the opening of the United Nations General Assembly, for example. Just like the Irgun, sending this direct message to diplomats. And we see then in the 1960s, really the archetypal exponents of this successful approach, the Palestinians. Now, not just using violence in their own country and focusing attention in that, but taking the struggle outside even the region of conflict, deliberately involving other citizens from other nations, and therefore creating this environment that no one can ignore their cause.
Let's get to the PLO. You say that the PLO invented modern international terrorism on July 22, 1968, with the hijacking of the Israeli El Al commercial flight from Rome to Tel Aviv. Just describe the act again and what happened.
Sure. Well, certainly there was nothing new about airline hijackings. In fact, the first one was perpetrated, I believe, in the 1930s. And certainly during the 1960s, there were any number of, for instance, homesick Cuban nationals hijacking American planes and going to return to Cuba, essentially. What separated the PLO's action, actually, it was the PFLP, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, one of the constituent members commanded by George Habash. What set this apart from those terrorist acts is that the motive was undeniably political. They were specifically targeting a symbol of sovereignty, of nationality. El Al is the Israeli national carrier. Also, too, I think they were using that airliner and its passengers as a form of traveling theater. In other words, they were creating a media event that was impossible to ignore, and that they could like turning on and off a faucet of water. They could, you know, increase the pressure by landing it dramatically in a foreign capital, issuing demands, then taking off again, landing again in another capital, issuing more demands. So it was a way to constantly apply pressure on governments. And I think this sent a powerful message to many similarly aggrieved minorities, ethnic nationalist groups throughout the world, who saw that through terrorism, they too could thrust hitherto ignored, disparaged causes and thrust those causes onto the world's agenda through a series of very well-timed and well-orchestrated acts of violence.
Another turning point that you mentioned in the history of modern terrorism is the attack at the Munich Olympics. Describe what happened then.
Well, there really what the...
This was 1972.
Right, it was September 1972. And what the terrorists did was, in essence, hijack the worldwide media that, of course, had descended on Munich to cover the Olympic Games, and to hijack that and to focus their attention, to wrest the world's attention from the sporting event to, on the one hand, the plight of these Israeli athletes, the 11 Israeli athletes that had been seized, but also, just as effectively, to focus worldwide attention on the Palestinians' plight. And I think one could quite persuasively argue that there were, whoever was ignorant of the Palestinians, of their cause, of their travails, of their, you know, refugee status, were far less ignorant in the days after the Munich Olympics, because now everyone knew about the Palestinians and knew about their plight.
Okay, so you just mentioned two major PLO terrorist actions that helped to bring their plight, you know, to the attention of the world. So then the world gets really familiar with the PLO, but the actions continue. At that point, what meaning do the actions have?
Well, the actions continue in the sense that the PLO, I think, spawned a lot of imitators, because no matter what governments say, they always say terrorism doesn't work, but many groups, not just the PLO, the Irgun, AOKA, the FLN, showed that terrorism does work, and it can be actually very effective, because why would anyone pay attention to these peoples and their causes if they weren't using violence? So I think the PLO spawned a whole raft of imitators or successors, but then you had a problem of an increasing number of terrorist groups competing for what one might describe as a diminishing audience share. In other words, terrorism wasn't quite the big news that it once was when the PLO burst on the scene with airline hijackings. You had even a very small dissident group, the South Moluccans in the Netherlands, for example, seizing a train. Again, following on this, they couldn't get on an airplane, so they seized a train instead. But following on this idea of seizing civilians and turning them into this traveling theater analogy I used. So the trouble is you have them more groups competing for attention that's becoming more used to terrorism. So I think tragically and unfortunately, in a pattern we still see today, that the answer for many of these groups is just to kill more and destroy more in order to get the same amount of attention that a far more discreet terrorist act might have gotten 10 or 15 years ago.
The major thing that you see happening now is the coming together of religious extremism and terrorism. What are the most recent examples of that that you would offer?
Well, I think the clearest, most recent example would be the bombings of the U.S. embassies in Tanzania and Kenya, where the motive, of course, is political, because terrorism itself, I think, has to be political. That's what separates it from other forms of violence that don't have this political motive. What's new is that there's now a religious justification or legitimization for the violence, that it's done not only as a way to influence people and to gain power to change mankind or to change international politics in a certain way, but it's being justified not on the basis of abstract ideologies, as was the case, let's say, during the Cold War, or even by ethno-nationalist justifications. But now, I mean, in essence, that they feel a divine mandate, that God is commanding them to carry out this violence to fulfill some sacred objective.
And what problems does that pose for a government that is being asked to respond to the terrorists?
Well, we see in Northern Ireland how there's the potential to solve a longstanding violent situation like that through negotiations, through political concession, through autonomy, power sharing, I think very standard political remedies. To a wholly terrorist who has a fundamentally different worldview, who feels, I think, very aggrieved and very much cast on the defensive. I mean, that's the other point, too, is that we tend to look at terrorists, particularly religious terrorists, as mindless fanatics. I think far from that. They actually have an inner logic, and they're also, to a certain extent, they see themselves as reluctant warriors. But how do you approach that person? What concession do you give to someone who believes they're committing violence to better serve God or to fulfill some divine mandate? I mean, it's hard to see how amnesties, economic incentives, for example, or some devolved form of autonomy or power sharing is going to satisfy those types of aims.
Well, let's take the bombings of embassies in Tanzania and Kenya. What would you what do you think we ought to understand about the terrorists and their motivations?
Well,
not that they've taken credit for it.
No, well,
that's part of the problem, isn't it? I mean, how can you respond at all if you don't even know who's responsible?
Well, I think that's hitting the nail on the head. I think terrorism has always been a very difficult, if not intractable, problem. But the bad news is it's become even more difficult because now you have a situation where terrorists don't claim credit. In the past, for example, the groups such as the traditional stereotypical terrorist organizations, like the various Palestinian groups, like the IRA, like the Basque separatist group, ETA, for example, the Red Army faction in Germany, would claim credit for what they did. And not only would they claim credit, but they would often in very turgid and overwrought prose, but explain to us exactly why they did it. So that also made our response, when we could fashion a response, somewhat easier because we knew how to address their problems. So I think the fundamental challenge with the East African bombings is first trying to divine what the terrorists want. I mean, it's a very different phenomenon now in that there hasn't been a credible claim issued. And the only sort of information one has are very vague and hazy demands that the United States withdraw all Crusader or infidel forces from what they see as the Holy Land, in other words, Mecca and Medina, Saudi Arabia, that is. You get to a position where, do you want a terrorist group, or even if this Osama bin Laden is obviously the person behind it, do you want one man dictating to a country what its foreign policy should be? But I think nonetheless, though, one has to understand that there's tremendous enmity now directed against the United States from certain parts of the world, and that obviously part of at least making progress against the problem is addressing the reasons and understanding the reasons why there is this enmity and working to ways to counter it.
My guest is Bruce Hoffman, author of the new book Inside Terrorism. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Bruce Hoffman. He's the author of the new book, Inside Terrorism. He is also the new director of the Washington office of the RAND Corporation, where he'll be focusing on terrorism research. One of the things we're seeing now, which has everybody very worried, is the coming together of religiously motivated terrorism with weapons of mass destruction. I mean, a good example would be the Aum Shinrikyo use of sarin gas in Japan. You say in your book that it used to be assumed that terrorists weren't going to use weapons of mass destruction. Why did anyone assume that?
Well, there was an adage that Brian Jenkins, who's really one of the founders of terrorism studies, had coined in the 1970s that at the time was quite accurate, that terrorists wanted a lot of people watching and a lot of people listening and not a lot of people dead. In other words, there was this assumption on the part of terrorists that they could kill small numbers but do so dramatically and get a lot of attention, whereas they risked, if they killed a lot of people, alienating precisely the same people of whom they wanted attention for. They weren't going to influence the world, let's say, to take their plight seriously if they killed a lot of people and therefore alienated any sympathy. That, I think, began to change with the advent of religious terrorism because the mechanisms or the means of justification and legitimization were very different. You didn't have people necessarily seeking to influence or to mold opinion as much as to serve their particular deity or their particular God and therefore wrap their violence in this justification that, I mean, if God knows I did it, that's fine. I don't have to publicize. I don't have to claim credit. And this, in turn, I think, has led to a built-in escalatory spiral, at least the potential for a built-in escalatory spiral, because many of these religious groups, because of their profound alienation, see the world in terms of us against them. And therefore, if you're not a member of their particular group, and this is why the nomenclature that religious terrorists use, all religious terrorists, is so fascinating. Their enemies are never spoken of in human terms. They're always dehumanized and called infidels, mud people, dogs, curs, things like that. that they feel they're unworthy of life, that God has anointed them as God's messengers, that is the terrorists, and that all these other people are nothing, so that to kill them, there's just very little restraint. I mean, to kill them is justified with religious liturgy and sanctioned by clerics. I mean, this is why in many of these groups, not just Islamic ones, they don't operate unless a religious figure blesses their act of violence. So this then for them justifies almost widespread open-ended violence against anyone who's not a member of their religious sect.
Do you think of the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City and the bombing of the World Trade Center as being both an example of religious groups using weapons of mass destruction?
No. I think, perhaps somewhat controversially, that both were religiously motivated. I think the World Trade Center, many people would agree with me that there was certainly a group of people brought together who were Muslims who were opposed United States support of Israel and various other Middle Eastern governments, and who, you know, were motivated, at least had come together, certainly through a common place of worship and a common belief system. Oklahoma City, I think that McVeigh very much traveled in white supremacist circles that not only were seditious and anti-federalist and also opposed to gun control, but also that very much believed in the Christian identity credo, which is really the thread, I think, that connects white supremacism in America together now. And it is very much of a religious movement. I mean, when McVeigh himself admitted that he was a Christian patriot, I think the import of that wasn't quite understood when it was reported that they thought, well, he's Christian, he's patriotic. But rather that refers to a specific belief system that incorporates the identity church and identity doctrine. So yes, I think it's religion. Weapons of mass destruction, no, because I think when we talk about weapon of mass destruction, we're really talking about a nuclear, biological, or chemical weapon that have the potential to kill in the thousands. I mean, it was tragic that 168 people perished in Oklahoma City and certainly several hundred were injured, that 12 people died at the World Trade Center and 5,000 were injured. But we're still talking about two conventional weapons. I mean, bombs, they were big bombs, and the bombs were designed to have a very profound effect to bring down two buildings. But it's still not, I think, technically what we really should call a weapon of mass destruction.
Do you think we should be preparing for terrorist attacks with weapons of mass destruction that will kill large numbers of people, nuclear, chemical, biological weapons?
Well, I think it's a genuine threat. The question is, it's a threat that's probably has low likelihood, but potentially astronomical consequences, both immediate and physical and psychological. And I think the challenge for any government is to steer that middle course between reacting prudently to a threat that's not that likely, but that will have enormous consequences.
My guest is Bruce Hoffman. He's the author of the new book, Inside Terrorism, and he's the new director of the Washington office of the RAND Corporation, where he will be focusing on terrorism research. There's a peace agreement in effect in Northern Ireland now. Looking back over the IRA's many years of terrorist actions, what would you say the IRA's legacy is now in the history of terrorism and its effectiveness?
I think quite simply that terrorism works. I think the IRA has shown through its persistence, certainly, that Irish nationalism was a force that had to be reckoned with, that couldn't be pushed aside, that had to be addressed. And then I think very much in recent years, particularly since the breakdown of the ceasefire and the initial ceasefire in 1996, they demonstrated quite clearly, again, this analogy of turning on the tap of violence, how pressure can be brought to bear against a government by disrupting all traffic going into London, for example, by plotting to blow up the electrical power supply that feeds into London, by threatening to blow up bridges, that violence can be a very effective lever in animating governments to come back to the negotiating table, even though they may have pledged that we wouldn't negotiate with those men of violence. So I think it's shown once again that terrorism works.
But it took a really long time for that peace agreement to be in place.
It has, and I shouldn't be completely cynical or pessimistic. I think that what's happened in Northern Ireland, I think, defies even the most pessimistic observers. But I think it's worked that way because it has less in some respects to do with what the IRA has done than the Irish people, and having been there several times myself, I mean, there is such a groundswell and feeling of the Irish people that they've had enough of this, that it's become powerful enough that the men of violence in both the nationalist and the unionist communities couldn't ignore it, that they had to respond to it. So I don't think we should give all that much credit to the sort of, you know, newfound peacefulness of either, the Irish Republicans or loyalists in Northern Ireland. I think a lot of the credit really goes to the people in Northern Ireland.
When you say terrorism works, do you mean that terrorism works when the terrorist group has a real legitimate political point that it's trying to make? Or do you mean that just any prolonged amount of violence against a power is eventually going to be effective?
Well, that's a very good question. I think one has to make a differentiation. I think on one level, terrorism works when it attracts attention to a particular group and to its cause that might not have been attracted had they not resorted to violence. Whether they can parlay or whether they can turn that attention into political leverage, I think involves the skills of people who have proven themselves to be either visionaries or statesmen. I mean, Menachem Begin would have to be one of those people too, but certainly Yasser Arafat, Gerry Adams today. So I think we have to be careful. I mean, it works. It certainly does provide attention on, as I said, hitherto ignored or rejected causes. It works less well and less consistency in actually bringing power or the fruition of a particular group's aims. But I think if used properly and applied strategically, it can bring to many aggrieved peoples the benefits that governments say terrorism doesn't bring to them.
I'm wondering, you know, from what you've seen of times when the terrorist group actually wins in the long run, what they do with the victory, you know?
Well, I think they find that it's easier to be a terrorist organization than it is actually to be a governing body. I think terrorist organizations are enormously innovative, enormously organizationally resilient in the sense that they're small, so they're not large bureaucracies. You have people who, revolution is the vocation, that's what they're all about, so that they're susceptible to change and they're willing to adjust and adapt. They often have to make do with very limited means and in resources. And I think they find once that they're in power that it's entirely different, that firstly they have constituents now that they have to directly answer to, not only whom in the past they could have purported to represent. They find that the issues of day-to-day governance are not nearly as romantic or, you know, that this idea of changing the world, now you've just got to achieve something like open up the sewage lines, for example, or send children to school. So I think that they find often in power, it's different than being in the terrorist organization when they come to power. And I think also, too, that they find that they're very intolerant of dissent and that often they suppress any attempt to either not just roll back the revolution, but to redefine the revolution in ways that their particular organization no longer thinks are appropriate. So you find this problem as we see, you know, the Palestine Authority of, you know, accusation of themselves being repressive towards the Palestinian people. So I think it's enormously difficult when they do come to power.
Well, Bruce Hoffman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Bruce Hoffman is the author of Inside Terrorism. He's the new director of the RAND Corporation's Washington office. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and by Random House, publishers of Her Too, The Making of Herceptin, a revolutionary treatment for breast cancer by Robert Bazell. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Irish writer Sebastian Barry discusses his new historical novel about a man who joins the British-led police in Ireland and is blacklisted by his friends in the IRA. Barry also wrote the play The Steward of Christendom. And David Bianculli reviews tonight's Columbo telemovie starring Peter Falk. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Joni Mitchell has a new CD called Taming the Tiger. It's her 19th album and her first release since Turbulent Indigo, 1994's Grammy Album of the Year. This was a startlingly unexpected award because, like several of Mitchell's immediately previous albums, it sold poorly and barely made a mark on the music scene. With Taming the Tiger, Mitchell seems to be reaching out with more accessible music than she's made in some time. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
I stepped outside to breathe the air and stare up at the stars. Big Dipper hanging there over the rental car. Over the rental car. I'm a runaway from the red groupies, from the hoods in the hood and the whiny white kids. Snoring, you know, taming the tiger.
You can't tame the tiger.
Tiger, tiger, burning bright.
In the title song of Joni Mitchell's new CD, she invokes William Blake. Her Tiger, Tiger, Burning Brightly is the same avid creature of naked ambition that led Blake to marvel, "Did he who made the lamb make thee?" And where Blake's stars threw down their spears, for Mitchell, they chucked down their spears. Like the English mystical poet, Joni Mitchell is an artistic autodidact. She experiments with guitar tunings and jazz bohemianism the way Blake did with poetic meter and religious iconography.
This is really something. People will be envious, but our roads aren't clear, so we mustn't rush. Still, we're burning brightly, clinging like fire to fuel. I'm grinning like a fool. Stay in touch. We should stay in touch. Oh, stay in touch. Touch. Part of this is permanent.
Mitchell said in a recent interview that the tentative, tender song Stay in Touch is about getting to know her now-grown daughter, Killoran, whom she gave up for adoption 35 years ago. Mitchell hasn't permitted herself such autobiographical freedom in ages, and you can hear a sense of relief in the music, in the way the massed guitars, primarily Mitchell's own, endlessly overdubbed, surge and swoop with exhilarating abandon. They're carried aloft by Brian Blade's airy drumming, and the periodic flutter of Wayne Shorter's saxophone. You can hear this collaboration clearly on Facelift, an affectionately sardonic response to an argument Joni had with her 86-year-old mother.
Oh, love takes so much courage. Love takes so much shit. She said, "You've seen too many movies, Joni." She said, "Snap out of it." Oh, the cold winds blew at our room with a view, all helpful and hopeful and candlelit. We kissed the angels and the moon eclipsed, you know. Happiness is the best. Facelift.
There are a couple of songs here, like No Apologies and the middle section of Taming the Tiger, with its pointless complaint about pop music as, quote, junk food for juveniles, that are marred by the sort of commentary that made her 1985 album Dog Eat Dog so trying. But even on these, the music is lush and enveloping, and elsewhere there's a welcome sense of humor peeking through.
Since I lost you, I can't get through the day without at least one big boo-hoo. The pain won't go away. What am I gonna do? Man from Mars, this time you went too far.
The first time I heard the opening line of Man from Mars, the way she pauses and moans the phrase, boo-hoo, I whooped with laughter. Here's sober-sided Joni having a bit of fun at the expense of her own carefully calculated melancholy. 31 years after getting a record deal, the kid from Saskatoon has found a way to have, as she herself recently said of Noel Coward, so much skill and so much to say without being heavy. Good for her.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Coming up, Irish writer Sebastian Barry. This is Fresh Air. Sebastian Barry is a writer from Dublin whose plays and stories cover key moments in his country's and his family's history. Theater critic Robert Brustein described him as one of three writers who justify the statement that at the end of the century, Ireland again seems to be the spawning ground for some of the strongest dramatic writing in the world. Barry's best-known work is the play The Steward of Christendom. His new novel, The Whereabouts of Aeneas McNulty, is about a young Irishman who joins the British Army in World War I. Finding no job opportunities back home after the war, he joins the British-led police force, the Royal Irish Constabulary. But his friends have joined the IRA in revolt against British rule, and those friends blacklist him and send him into exile. I asked Sebastian Barry to describe what the Royal Irish Constabulary meant after World War I.
It was the police force of the country, essentially. And indeed, it was the refuge of many a young man, and many an Irish Catholic family was reared on the wages of a policeman. But of course, as after 1916, after the revolution, as the War of Independence got going, imperial institutions began to mean something quite different, and a job that might have been quite all right, quite admirable, quite normal, suddenly becomes the job of a traitor.
I'd like you to read a short excerpt of your new novel, The Whereabouts of Aeneas McNulty, and this passage describes a little of what the RIC is like when Aeneas joins it.
Out at six they are, in their grey coats, the peaks on the caps as black as blackbird's feathers, and rain or shine the boots, making the crippled cobbles ring, and they wheel and stamp and take the orders as the one animal. 100 boys in similar coats, and the fresh reds of the dawn, cluttering up the lower gaps between the buildings. At end of training, each man gets his gun and bullets. All about the barracks, the countryside is boiling with sedition and treachery and hatred, according to the Sergeant William Doyle of Leitrim. Of Leitrim in these latter years, but an Athlone boy in times gone by, so he will tell you. As such, a useful man to herd his men about the dangerous districts. And indeed, ferocious events are afoot in the sacred web of fields and rainy towns. It isn't just murders and such or killings, you couldn't call them that. Wherever an RIC man uses a gun and wounds or kills in a skirmish, some man in his uniform is taken, and God help him, in the dark hedges and isolated farms. Such a man might be gutted with a big knife and his entrails fed to the homely pig in front of him, and the last leaks of life drained out of him then slowly and silently, with terrible swipes. Next thing, the RIC is augmented, as the official word goes, with an auxiliary force, and now the merry dance gets wilder back and forth. For these are men as strange and driven as the Irish heroes themselves.
That's Sebastian Barry reading from his novel The Whereabouts of Aeneas McNulty. Many of the members of the Royal Irish Constabulary at the time your novelist said have just come back from World War I. How do you think that affected their behavior and their view of their work?
The most notorious group of the period was the Black and Tans, the Black and Tans were really a ferocious group of people, and they were attached to the RIC as an auxiliary group. And it's sad, really, that they were composed sometimes of heroes of the First War. And, you know, in our terms, maybe with greater understanding, you know, say post-Vietnam, of those traumas, heroes that were, you know, without help, who were unreconstituted. And I think, you know, some of the Irishmen who came back from the war, conversely, went into the other side of things, and the trauma of the war informed their actions within the early revolutionary movement.
Well, you mean the Irish soldiers who fought for the British during World War One ended fighting against them?
For the British, we say now, but, you know, all our grandparents were born British. Mm-hmm. Ireland was British, and there wasn't that distinction. The distinction was created by the movement towards independence. So, you know, extraordinary, in 1916, the very day of the uprising, you know, groups of soldiers were being sent to the North Wall to be shipped out to France. And when the news of the rising came, they were sent back into the city to deal with the revolutionaries. But they themselves were composed of Irish people. I mean, you can see how impossibly complicated that made not only that present time, but the future and the memories that people had of that time. And there was so much to hide and so much covering over. It's part of the engine of this book is that such a man as this not only had to erase his own life, but had his life erased because it's inconvenient history, you know, for a family to function in Ireland.
Who is the character of Ennius based on?
I almost hesitate to say he's based on, but the little feather I had to begin the bird of the book, let's say, was a great uncle of mine. And again, I say great uncle of mine with great confidence, and yet he's so shadowy. Sometimes I wonder, did he even exist? This man did something or other at that time in Ireland in the 20s, got himself into some sort of trouble. I mean, it's very vague with you know, whatever the revolutionary movement was, and did have to leave Ireland, and was not heard of again. I think my mother remembers him very vaguely trying to come back to Ireland, you know, like a pigeon homing, and they weren't even allowed go near him in the house when he was back. They weren't even allowed to tell anyone he was home, so that when this man was home, his real name was Charlie. When Charlie was home, Charlie was not home. And, you know, for me as a child, that was an anecdote. And indeed, it became a rather exciting anecdote when my grandfather, his brother, told me the story of tracking down this man through the War Office, because he hadn't seen him for decades, and it was his own brother. And they'd both been in the army, so he was able to get his address at the War Office in London. And he went to a little hotel on the Isle of Dogs, which is just at the edges of London City, and asked for this man, and was told, yes, he did live there, but wasn't there that evening, and to come back in the morning. Now, my grandfather neglected to give his name. He said he was from Sligo. And when he came back the next morning, he found the hotel burned to the ground. And he assumed that, or he told me that he assumed, which might be a different thing, that he had been followed from Sligo by these, you know, the men in dark coats intent on their vendetta. And they had dealt with Charlie and given him the concrete boots and put him in the Thames. Or Charlie, hearing that somebody from Sligo was looking for him, had panicked and burnt the hotel.
So did your uncle die in this hotel fire?
Well, this was the curious thing. Everyone assumed he had. Everyone assumed he was long dead. But In the very week that I was not so much finishing the book, but looking around for a new name for him, and, you know, that stage of a novel, and an aunt of mine got in touch with my family and said she'd just received a small bequest, and it was from him, and he had just died at a great age in an old people's home in London. So It really did confuse me in a good way at the time, because it seemed to me that just as he was becoming completely fictional, just as I realized it was pointless to keep his real name because I had invented him entirely, you know, the real man sent a sort of curious signal of ending himself, and allowed the book, you know, to just step forward completely then into the realms of fiction. You know, a sort of double dance of things. It was quite intriguing.
You had a great-grandfather who was a superintendent in the Dublin Metropolitan Police, and this was the Dublin police force right before independence.
Mm-hmm.
You describe him as the man with the responsibility for Dublin Castle, the very heart of British rule in Ireland in that period. Tell me more about your great-grandfather's role within the Dublin Metropolitan Police.
Well, you see how I assert that fact. I was probably on the book cover, is it? Or I can't remember now, but I do remember writing that phrase. That is a phrase, you know, even 10 years ago, I wouldn't have dared to write.
Why not?
Because when I first, you know, when I was a child, I did have an idea of this man. He was chief superintendent of B Division, and he was responsible, therefore, for Dublin Castle and the area around Dublin Castle. So when James Larkin, the great Labour leader, had his illegal rally in O'Connell Street, the main street of Dublin, my great-grandfather led the charge against the striking workers. And I, as a little boy, I had this idea of him on a big white horse, you know, charging forward in a kind of a heroic manner. But, you know, by God, later on, when I started to think about it, it was dreadful. It was like suddenly discovering that you had, you know, a sort of little Hitler in your background. And that's what it felt like. So I wouldn't have dared to write that phrase. And I think it is the mercy of modern Ireland, you know, one of the great turning of the soil of Ireland that peace makes possible, that all these stories can be kind of disinterestedly released into the air, you know, brought back for their significance or for their lack of significance.
Have you found that many families in Ireland have stories like yours where there's somebody in the family who there has been great shame about and great secrecy about?
Yeah, very much so. And, you know, that's one of the great heartening things, that somehow by, you know, writing a book like this or writing a play like that, you have said it. So you have said the darkest possible thing. So that allows other people simply to say, oh, I had a great uncle in the earth. And it releases, it brings access to other memories. And people have quite passionately, I mean, deeply passionately come up and talked about their, you know, their uncle or their grandfather or whatever who were in these forces or had these jobs. And of course, for the time, since it had been British for, you know, 600 years in Ireland, it was the status quo. And it is like a world erased by the necessity of the new nationalist history. A perfectly legitimate thing. But now Ireland, which is, you know, whatever it is, 70 years old, as it were, is fit and ready to accommodate all these other things. And a great retrieval of memory and imagination is the harvest of that, of the courage to do that.
As you know, President Clinton now is dealing with the Starr Report and the whole Monica Lewinsky scandal. When people try to talk about the strengths of his administration, the good that he's done, one of the first things that's mentioned is the peace agreement in Northern Ireland. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering what the president's profile is like now in Ireland and how his profile is being affected by the Starr Report.
Right. He is simply speaking, he's a hero in Ireland. He came in 1995. He changed the climate of things in the way that he was asked to do, you know, by people like John Hume. He promised to come back. From our point of view, he hurried back after the enormous tragedy of Omagh. He came back as quick as he could. That's how it seemed to us. And he was welcomed, I mean, as a bringer of peace in Ireland. And I think it would be insanely unfair to regard that as a political move. It certainly wasn't felt, it didn't look like, and I don't think was, you know, a simple political move. He came because he seems to believe in this crucial cause.
Now, you're Catholic and your wife is Protestant. Is that mm-hmm. considered anything worth remarking on in Dublin?
No, not at all, you know. And, I mean, that's one of the greatest hopeful things. You know, after 70 years, it doesn't matter halfpence what religion you are.
It would still matter in Northern Ireland. People would still remark on
it. In certain districts, it would be the death of you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And indeed, you know, when the little Quinn boys were burned to death, it struck me very forcibly that...
These were the three sons of a Catholic Protestant marriage.
Yes. And, you know, that we were living in a housing estate in the south of Ireland, and they were up there. And the idea of somebody marching up to our house and throwing a petrol bomb would be so impossible, it would be absurd. It would be beyond the bounds of possibility. And yet it was very much a possibility, and not only a possibility, but an event. It did happen up there. And we are no longer content to say, you know, let there be two Irelands, and say that that's happening up there. The great change, I think, in the English as spoken in Ireland, is that we now talk about we instead of they up in the north. You know, this new word we on the island of Ireland has been the sort of mantra of politicians who have been trying to perhaps, you know, not have a united Ireland, but to have a united island. A thing fervently to be wished for, you know.
Sebastian Barry. His new novel is called The Whereabouts of Aeneas McNulty. Coming up, Columbo returns again. This is Fresh Air. Tonight on ABC, Peter Falk is back as Lieutenant Columbo, a role he first took on 30 years ago. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
Even though Peter Falk has been playing Lieutenant Columbo off and on since the Johnson administration, it's been a lot more off than on. The original series was part of a rotating wheel of mystery telemovies, so there were only a handful of new Columbos each season, 45 overall from 1968 to 78. Falk took 10 years off, then started playing the character again in one-shot telemovies. Tonight's installment, subtitled Ashes to Ashes, is the 22nd of those, and the 67th Columbo mystery overall. It's also one of the best. Before this, the last few Columbo movies have been relative disappointments. Instead of using original stories and scripts, Falk tried to use and adapt existing stories by Ed McBain. It was about as good a fit as Columbo's rumpled raincoat. But tonight's story, written by Jeffrey Hatcher, is a Columbo original in the classic mode, and with a classic villain. The villain this time is played by Patrick McGoohan, who also directs the telemovie, and, along with Falk, is credited as co-executive producer. This is the fourth time McGoohan has played a bad guy on Columbo, which sets an all-time record. On two of his previous guest shots, McGoohan won Emmy Awards, and I wouldn't be surprised at all if he wins another one for tonight's performance. In Ashes to Ashes, he plays a mortician who commits an unpremeditated murder. Because of his particular occupation, he has quite an advantage when it comes to disposing of the body. Columbo finally figures out what may have happened to the missing female victim. But in this case, figuring it out may not be enough. In this scene, Fox Columbo presents his theory of the crime, but McGoohan's character just teases him. So much so that Columbo, usually the most persistent of conversationalists, actually exits the room while his prime suspect is still talking. The way these two actors play this scene demonstrates how Falk and McGoohan, these two TV perfectionists, work so perfectly together.
Now, this is a pager. She had this model, sir, or she carried this with her everywhere, probably in her pocket, and this would tell her when she received email messages from the computer. And you know, on the day she disappeared, she received messages, oh, let's see, 11:13 and 11:57. But then, at 12:32, the pager cut off. No more signals. Kaput.
What do you think caused that?
That is a burning question, sir. I think she was dead.
Really?
Yeah, I think she was killed right here at the Houston service.
But what would the killer do with the body?
He would get rid of it. He cremated.
But there was only one cremation that day. That was Chuck Houston's, and I did it.
Yeah, so the killer would have had to have switched the bodies. Switched Chuck Houston with Miss Chandler.
I see. So if he had switched the bodies, that would explain how the pager went kaput.
Yes, sir. It would.
Yes, I see. Well, since there was only one cremation that day and I performed it, that would make me the murderer. Do tell me, do you have any bodies?
No, sir, I don't.
So if you don't have any bodies, you can't prove that there was a switch?
No, sir, I can't.
No bodies, no case.
Mm-hmm. I suppose so.
Well, that's the tricky thing about burning questions. Once they're burned, they're just ashes. Ashes, have you gone?
I know ABC is putting Columbo up against NBC's Frasier and ER, where it doesn't stand a chance, except among older viewers, where it's good counter-programming. But far from being an old show past its prime, Columbo is back to top form and deserves as much attention, as much respect, and as many viewers as it can get.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Princeton University Press, publishers of The Shape by the River by William G. Bowen and Derek Bach, an examination of race-sensitive college admission policies and their long-term consequences. In bookstores or on the web, pup.princeton.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.